This is the current federal tax developments for the week of July 27th, 2015. Current federal tax developments are brought to you by Nichols Patrick CP Incorporated and your state society of CPAs. We're going to take a look at what has gone on this here in the final week of July of 2015, as what's happened to us in the area of federal tax developments, and look at some of the recent cases and some items of interest. We're going to start out here with a chief counsel advice. This is Chief Counsel Advice 2015-29008. And this Chief Counsel Advice deals with a rental car company that was claiming casualty losses on cars damaged in auto accidents. In this particular case, the rental car company treated losses from car accidents as casualty losses if a renter had purchased the damage waiver. And the rental car company, after the car was involved in an accident, determined that it wasn't worthwhile to repair the car and put it back in the fleet, since they disposed of the car. They have been treating them as casualty losses for this point, to claim the losses as a casualty item, and they were being able to claim that on their return. Now, obviously, the issue became, are these truly casualty losses? Generally, be a casualty loss under Section 165 of the Code, you've got to meet three criteria. It has to be an event that is identifiable, it has to result in damage to the property, and it has to be a sudden, unexpected, and unusual in nature event. The question became whether it was the last one. Was it sudden, unexpected, and unusual in nature? The chief counsel advice concluded that, in fact, if you're an auto car, if you're renting cars, if you're Hertz, your Avis, your Enterprise, reality is a number of your customers are going to be involved in accidents, probably on a daily basis. Now, percentage-wise, it's going to be a small part of your fleet, but it's going to be consistently happening to the fleet. Because of that, it's not unusual for a company in the rental car business to have these accidents and incur these expenses. So while such an accident would generally be a casualty loss if incurred by, let's say, a normal business, or if incurred by an individual, for the purpose of casualty loss rules under this test, for a rental car company, this is simply a standard piece of doing business. As such, the IRS concluded, the rental car company could not properly treat this as a casualty loss under Section 165. And the chief counsel advised the agent dealing with this company that essentially that was a treatment. The treatment of this should not go under the casualty loss rules, and that other treatment should be taken for this purpose. So it's not going to be a casualty loss issue. It's going to be something different. Next up, we have a private letter ruling, 2015-30024. An interesting part of this one is we seem to have a return here to the kinder, gentler IRS. And the issue here revolves around the question of when a taxpayer is going to be judged to be eligible to get an extended rollover period when they foul up on rolling over their IRA. In this particular case, which is Private Letter Ruling 2015-30024, the issue occurred because the taxpayer in question made a bit of a mistake or made an assumption turned out not to be true. The general rule is that Revenue Procedure 2003-16 provides the facts the IRS will consider when a taxpayer goes for a late rollover of an IRA. And the issues they provide there, they provide a list of options that shall be considered. The first option, the first fact that they say will be considered among the facts and circumstances in determining if it's okay for the IRS to grant that extended relief generally is going to be if the taxpayers failed to get an IRA completed due to an error on the part of a financial institution. Now, in this case, the taxpayer erroneously established an online non-IRA account. What happened was this. According to the facts in the ruling, the taxpayer had found an ad in a newspaper for an online bank that was offering a rate of return that was better than the bank in which he had his IRA. The taxpayer therefore withdrew funds from the IRA in the bank he had it at and went to open a new account at the online bank. The facts don't tell us that the individual at this point ever contacted anyone at the online bank. He apparently was reading things on the web, and we don't know for sure what exactly he read, but we do know that at the end of the day, he put the money into an account a few days after it came out, and that particular account was not an IRA account. Now, for some reason, less than a month after the 60-day period ended, but obviously about 2 months after he had put the money in there, it occurred to him to call that online bank, talk to a live individual, and ask whether the account he'd established was truly an IRA account. He got bad news. It turns out that this particular online bank doesn't offer IRA accounts, so clearly what he had put money in was not an IRA account. Now he's got a problem because we're past the 60-day period and the funds have been sitting in a non-IRA account, and as the deadline passed, they were still sitting there. Now, early on, after Rev. Proc 2003-16 was released, we generally found that if a taxpayer was the one responsible for the problem, and the service would look at things like, did the taxpayer fill in the form wrong and check the wrong box to set up the type of account? If it was a taxpayer error, generally the IRS would rule that that was not a financial institution error, and because of that, they would not grant the 60-day rollover. But in this case, the IRS concluded, the statement they made was, that because the financial institution provided quote-unquote misleading information, an interesting aside in this case is that we were never told in any of the facts what exactly that misleading information was. All we know is the taxpayer established an account. That's the only fact recited. But because they decided that the financial institution had provided, quote, misleading information, because we do know the taxpayer believed he'd set up an IRA, that they treated that as an error by the financial institution, and the IRS granted this taxpayer the right to make a late IRA rollover. That issue means that, of course, the taxpayer was able to avoid paying tax, and they had 60 days after the letter was issued to actually move the funds into an IRA account, which the taxpayer did. Now, there are a couple of takeaways from this. The first takeaway is that, obviously, the service may grant you relief in cases where in the past you might have gathered from looking at rulings that relief would be unavailable to your taxpayer. But the downside of this to always remember is, while that's true, remember, to get relief, you still must ask for a private letter ruling. You cannot go ahead and make the late rollover unless you meet the narrow circumstances in this Rev Proc, unless you get the IRS's official permission to make the late rollover. And even if you believe you have a true, pure financial statement, financial institution error, it still probably makes sense to go for the ruling, because the downside of the IRS later claiming that that was not a financial institution error is pretty nasty, with the overfunding penalties in the IRA that will go on for each year that you have the excess funds in there, plus the problem of having to pay tax on that first rollover. So we have issues involving. But certainly, if you do have a taxpayer who blew the 60-day election, 60-day rollover, and they didn't use the funds for other purposes, it appears the IRS is much more apt to take a sympathetic view of the client's reasons for having fouled up the rollover. Next up in our information are proposed regulations. This is Regulation 115452-14, proposed regulations under Section 707 of the Internal Revenue Code. These particular regulations are going to deal with partnerships disguised payments for services. The proposed regulations are dealing with a situation where a partnership has made a payment that it purports not to be a payment for services. Most often it's going to purport that this payment is represented to be a distribution to a partner who purchased an interest in the interest. So we're going to take a look at that. Under Section 707A2A, if a partnership engages in a disguised payment procedure where we have a disguised transaction that appears to be a distribution or something similar but is actually something else, the IRS is given the right to force that to be recast the other way. Now, the IRS has decided we need to have regulations in this area to clarify. The regulations look primarily at, these proposed regulations, whether a service provider actually has entrepreneurial risk. That is, whether or not there's going to be a entrepreneurial risk where the taxpayer is really at risk for items in this. And as they say, some ways that they might not be is if the partners, you know, whether a partner has a transitory ownership in the interest, whether the allocation and distribution made to the partner are close in time to when the services were performed, or if the facts and circumstances indicate that the recipient became a partner primarily to obtain tax benefits for itself or the partnership that could not otherwise have been obtained had there been a direct payment for services, and whether the value of the interest in general and in continuing partnership's profits is small in relation to the allocation in question that is being taken for the services. In the proposed regulations, these factors move directly in, and the IRS makes clear that this entrepreneurial risk test is the key test to determine if a service provider's payments are truly disguised payments for services, which generally is going to be taxable to the recipient and treated as paid by the partnership, and whatever the partnership can get for a deduction there, for whatever the services were for, that's a whole different issue. They may have to capitalize them into certain things. But the regulation does add that there'll be five other criteria to be considered. Those five other items to consider in addition to, or I should say, there actually are, first, there are some factors that presumptively establish the lack of entrepreneurial risk in these regulations. Let's get to that first. If you have capped allocations of partnership income, if the cap is reasonably expected to apply in most years, so we're pretty much sure they're going to get that number, an allocation for one or more years under which a service provider's share of income is reasonably certain, so we know basically what they're going to get for each year, if there is an allocation made out of gross income to a service provider, an allocation under a formula or otherwise that's predominantly fixed in amount is reasonably determined under all the facts and circumstances, or is designed to assure sufficient net profits are highly likely to be available to make allocation to the provider. That is, like if the partnership agreement provides for an allocation of net profits from specific transactions or accounting periods, and this allocation does not depend on long-term future success of the enterprise, or an arrangement in which a service provider waives its right to receive payment for the future performance of services in a manner that is non-binding or fails to timely notify the partnerships and its partner of the waiver of the term. Now, this is a presumption, it's not absolute, so we have those, though, have a tough time with services, so didn't have these guys say. Then we get on to these other treatments that will be involved, and the regulations provide that there will be other rules that will be involved, the other five, the other factors that are involved, this is it. If those factors are, it's the service pressure duration, receives an allocation distribution of time frame that's comparable to the time frame a non-partner service provider would typically receive payment. The provider became a partner primarily to obtain tax benefits. This is very similar to the others you may notice. The value of the interest in general in continuing partnership's profits is small, or the arrangement provides for different allocation of distributions with respect to different services received. They're provided by one person or by persons that are related under Section 707B or 267B, and the terms of the effect of the differing allocation of distributions are subject to levels of entrepreneurial risk that vary significantly. Finally, the IRS has noted that they plan to issue additional guidance to modify the provisions of Revenue Proc 9327 regarding the issuance of a profits interest for services to provide an additional exception that deals with issues related to this. So the idea being the proposed revenue procedure, which is found in Notice 2005-43, we'll talk about this, will apply to a profits interest issued in conjunction with a partner foregoing payment of an amount that is substantially fixed, including a substantially fixed amount determined by formula, such as a fee based on a percentage of partner capital commitments for performance of services, including a guaranteed payment under 707C or a payment in a non-partner capacity under 707A. The IRS claims these regulations reflect congressional intent. Therefore, even though they don't apply until the regulations go final, it seems to make sense that it's likely on current exams the IRS is going to argue that these regs still reflect how things should be taxed. Don't be surprised to see the service use this regulation to attempt to resolve this issue in exams that you are currently facing or with your partnerships that you currently are making decisions in this area on. Next up is the case of Stout versus Commissioner, Tax Court Memorandum Decision 2015-133, which was issued on July the 21st. In this particular case, a taxpayer received payments for stock incentive units. His employer had established a plan for employees where they would be receiving these things called stock incentive rights. These stock incentive units that would be issued to full-time salary employees of the company who had been employed a minimum of 3 years and serving key executive, administrative, professional, or technical capacities. Now, the value of each of these accounts was maintained by an adjustment to reflect changes in the fair value of a share of the employer's common stock, and for each of those units, they had a credit to their account equal to cash dividends relating to a share of common stock. These dividends would accrue interest if they weren't currently paid. Eventually, the employer was acquired by another company, and that company bought out the rights in this plan. The taxpayer in this case claimed that those payments should be a capital gain, that he had a sale of a capital asset. But the tax court points out that the plan specifically stated the amounts credited to the plan represent only an unsecured promise to pay with the terms of the plan, and the plan specifically said that they would not require any right, title, or interest in the assets of the property. If there was a merger acquisition, the plan participants would receive cash payments equal to the value of their plan account, which is what happened in this case. The tax court pointed out he had no ownership interest in shares. Under basically Section 1221, you cannot have a gain on a sale of a capital asset unless there's actually a capital asset that is sold. And the courts have ruled numerous times that a right to receive ordinary income in the future is not a capital asset. Rather, in this case, Stout must treat the amount he received as ordinary income. He cannot tax it as capital gain. Even though it looked like stock, even though it may have performed like, in essence, he got more to his account, if the price went up of this share, so he got an amount equal to the value of the share, if he got a dividend, there'd be a dividend credit to his account. The fact that it was like that account, this is not horseshoes. Close is not good enough. In this case, that's simply a compensation arrangement for the employee, and as such, the employee must recognize the amount of income as ordinary income and not taxable as capital gain income. Finally, this week, our final case, we actually get to an estate tax case. This is the case of the estate of Pulling Sr. versus Commissioner, Tax Court Memorandum Decision 2015-134. This particular case involves parcels of land held by the estate. The estate held three parcels of land, and a company for which the estate owned a minority interest in, but a significant interest, but a minority interest in, owned two other parcels of land. These five parcels of land, if they were combined together, could clearly be used or basically sold to somebody to develop the property. And that development would make the property far more valuable than its current status, where it was zoned for agricultural use only. Now, couldn't get to the party estate's land except by driving through the land that was held by the other entity. The other entity had other shareholders, one of whom had originally been a close friend of the deceased, and there were various other closely related parties in that group. The IRS claimed that the proper valuation of the land should be considering that it would be the value as developed of those parcels, stating that, in fact, you know, that was the highest use. The partnership objected, noting that it could not develop those parcels or sell it to a developer unless it got the acquiescence of the owners of the other two parcels to combine their parcels with those of the estate. The tax court took a look at this situation, and the court took a look at the facts. Now, the IRS claimed that because it was obviously so much more valuable if these properties were developed, that by definition, there'd be no problem getting the other party to agree to sell the parcels as one, and that that would, in fact, be the smart things to do. And based on that, therefore, the highest and best use should be the developed version of the parcels, or the parcels available for development. However, the tax court noted that, in fact, the test under the tax law is whether it is reasonably probable, under prior case law, that the consent of the other party would be obtained and they would come together to sell this property. The court found that the facts of this case did not establish that. It pointed out that the other entity had been offered an ability to sell the property at a premium prior to the death of the decedent, and that they had turned it down. That the members of that group indicated they would not be interested in selling it to anyone who would develop the property. That was against what they wanted done with the property. The court also noted that the IRS's own expert had conceded in his testimony that he could not advise any buyer to buy the property as an investment property because of the risk that they would not be able to get the consent of the other party to actually be able to use the property for the highest and best use. Therefore, the court concluded, lacking any evidence that it was reasonably probable that the estate would have obtained, or a buyer of the property would be able to obtain the consent of the other party, a reasonable buyer would not have valued this land at the use as a developed piece of land. The party would rather value it at the much lower level, which the estate had provided for in its appraisal. And because of that, the court found that the IRS was in error, and in fact, the estate did not owe extra funds. On its return, on its estate tax return, the estate's valuation was considered to be the correct valuation. This has been the current federal tax developments for the week of July the 27th, 2015. Be sure to visit our website at currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com for write-ups about these cases, as well as for information regarding the links to the source documents that support the items we talked about this week. You can also find updates during the week at that website as developments occur during the week, so be sure to visit there. We look forward to seeing you next week, and we'll talk to you again about what's been going on in the area of federal taxes.